There are no bodhisattvas. There is only bodhisattvic action. There is no self-centeredness. There's only self-centered activity, entanglement. Of course, all of you are bodhisattvas. That means all of you have the capacity, the ability to manifest responding compassionately in this moment, responding with wisdom skillfully in this moment. When we speak of bodhisattvas, we have names such as Manju or Manjushri or Kuan Yin, the bodhisattva who responds to the cries of suffering. Kuan Yin is another name for Avalokiteshvara. So Avalokiteshvara is the bodhisattva who relieves the suffering by responding to the cries and takes all the many forms. There's sutras that discuss all the different ways that the bodhisattva will appear, responding to the cries of those who are caught in their self-delusion that creates difficulties. See, it's when we see either ourself or others in a solid, fixed way that gives rise to us creating difficulties by believing that story and not allowing, so to speak, the free responding, either by ourselves or by others. Everyone you meet is capable of freely responding in compassion, which is in being this ongoing change of cause and effect, this ongoing interdependence, and compassionately responding out of being this moment, out of not being trapped by stories of self and other, or not being caught by the cause and effect that manifests as self-clinging, as attachment, as, and you could describe different ways that self-centeredness, but not self-centeredness, but self-centering, which isn't really a word, and yet it is. That self-centering manifests with what we call greed, anger, confusion of dualism, of what I am and what I'm not, and what I need and what I want. It's the belief and the holding to that belief. Is what keeps us and others caught. Everyone you meet, everyone, is nothing but this bodhisattvic functioning, except to the extent that we and they are blinded, and we and they have the capacity, are the capacity of each moment, which means when we sit, even though entangling thoughts and fears arise, we have the capacity to not hold on to them, to not entangle ourselves further in judging them. Therefore, we can be this moment ongoing change, which is the universe, which is our life, which is breathing, which is listening. And in being that, we are able to be joyous. Not because we do something else, but because we don't believe that story that we tell ourselves about I am, he is, she did that to me, they're going to. See, when we solidify others in that way, we solidify ourselves. Even if we solidify others as they are or they're not bodhisattva, that doesn't mean that the very, so to speak, same person who can be compassionate one minute can turn around and be vicious and angry in another, and caught in that, and causing harm to themselves and others. See, because we have that capacity, that's the capacity we all have of freely functioning in the midst of this ongoing change. And this ongoing change is nothing but who we are, except if we believe that we're not that, except if we believe we're solid, except if we then, if I use the term, project solidity onto others, as opposed to being able to appreciate their bodhisattvic function. Bodhisattvic means not holding on to what I want, but seeing what's called for and enabling beings, all beings, to be liberated from what results in their suffering. Whether it's simply giving you change when you purchase something and say, here, thank you, with a smile, or in a way that acknowledges you and them. That's bodhisattvic functioning. Except if we don't see it, then we disregard it. Every being that you encounter is capable of this, because every being you encounter, including yourself, is nothing but this. Except when we're caught up in clinging, in attaching, in what we generally call self-centeredness. Caught up in the conditions that we think we are or we're are not, or the conditions that others, conditions and characteristics, are and are not. That person is mean. That person is, that circumstance is. You don't have to believe me about this. The third ancestor in Chan tradition, in Xin Xin Ming, which is on believing in mind, Saint San is the name of the third ancestor. Has a phrase, those who possess insight are always without doings or without characteristics, meaning they don't hold on to those conditions. Only fools tie themselves into knots over conditions. See, it's not that conditions don't arise, they arise, they pass, they arise, they pass. But if we don't cling and attach to them, see, because fundamentally they're not the arising conditions except this moment, it's when they arise, we're there present in their arising. When we see them for what they are, then we can be embracing and appreciative of the way it is and do what's called for as best we can. See? Otherwise, as he says a little further, we go astray, and then stillness becomes confused and we lose insight. See, insight has to do with how we're become caught by likes and dislikes. It's not the likes and dislikes, but the getting caught, the one-sidedness. So the reason I start like this is, on the one hand, I want us all to know and appreciate our capacity and ability for bodhisattvic functioning. Even sitting, bodhisattvic functioning is the ability to be open to whatever arises and yet not solidify it and react. Bodhisattvic functioning means also not to hold on to stories about so-called past and so-called future. And because each of us has this capacity, each and every person that you've ever and will ever encounter has this capacity. Even the most, quote, terrible person, close quote, in your life also has the capacity of bodhisattvic functioning, not because they do something special, but because when the blinders of self-centeredness dissipate for a moment, and they do, because just as everything else, self-centeredness just arises and passes. They're capable of smiling and saying thank you. Right there is bodhisattvic functioning. Our job is to nurture that in everyone we encounter, as opposed to nurturing and feeding the fear and anger of self-centeredness, whether in terms of our pictures of them and our reactions to them, or our own fears and angers over them. Okay. I have one thing more I want to say, and then we can open this up, since what I find is most useful, especially at the beginning of Sesshin, is not for me to talk exclusively, but rather to use this opportunity to help clarify what our Sesshin practice is, so that we could all make good use of this wonderful opportunity we have of sitting together, of being here and being this practice for a few days. See? Because we are ongoing change, cause and effect, that's interrelated. Our efforts, directly, indirectly, immediately or not so immediately, our efforts is what nurtures and supports further functioning of compassion and wisdom. Our efforts is what supports our practice and that of others. Whether we see it directly or not is secondary or sometimes irrelevant and a way to distract ourselves. But it's important to spread this in many directions, including directions that are hard to. Recently, there was a memorial for a friend of mine, a Zen teacher, who died suddenly. And in that memorial, someone else quoted a poem by Uchiyama Roshi. Uchiyama Roshi was the abbot of a small monastery in Japan. Antaiji is the name of that monastery, and he was a successor of Kodo Sawaki Roshi. So this is a poem he wrote, and you'll see in a moment why it was raised up. And this poem was translated by his successor, Shohaku Okamura. It's life and death. Water isn't formed by being ladled into a bucket. Simply, the water of the whole universe has been ladled into a bucket. The water does not disappear because it has been scattered over the ground. It is only that the water of the universe has been emptied into the universe. Life is not born because a person is born. Life of the whole universe has been ladled into the hardened idea called I. Life does not disappear because a person dies. Simply, the life of the whole universe has been poured out of this hardened idea of I back into the universe. This hardened idea of I keeps on being created when we hold to self-centeredness or project self-centeredness onto others, because self and others, both forms of the same thing. It's our opportunity to allow the life of the universe, which is bodhisattvic functioning, to manifest in ourself and others by not holding on to self ideas, other ideas, when they arise. Then, for that moment, the capacity and opportunity of universal bodhisattvic functioning, the right here now opportunity, and of the endless dimension, universal life can appear. That's all of our opportunities. That's all of our practice. Even awakening wherever you, where you see it, think of it, isn't some sort of hardened idea. It's just the arising this moment of awakening to the universal endless dimension that we are. Trying to hold on to it just is more clinging. Then we could live awakening, awakening, awakening. Compassion, compassion, compassion. Wisdom, wisdom, wisdom. Bodhisattva. We don't even need such words, but since we already use words, these words are good antidotes for words that would, might otherwise lead to clinging and believing conditions and characteristics. So, okay, I'll stop now and we can maybe explore this together a bit as our practice opportunity to support the session. Yes?
So what you spoke was a perfect example of something that I experienced this week. And it seems to me that self-clinging prevented me from responding rationally to another human being in a situation where there were many human beings. And it created a clash between us, and it was sort of explosive. And when it was over, I knew that I had contributed to this by self-clinging. I thought I was in the right. I thought I had done enough research that I shouldn't be questioned. And when I went into this meeting, I expected to hear one thing, and I heard something totally different.
Yeah.
And it surprised me so much that this first anger reaction happened, and then it snowballed. So even though the entire board approved what I asked for, the whole of the universe has been caught up for me in this conflict. And if when I see my part in it that was wrong, the humiliation is so huge that I can hardly deal with it. So I either have humiliation or I have anger. And I'm sitting with it and sitting with it and sitting with it, and it's right here, right here. And there you go.
Yes. And it's wonderful that it's right here, that you can see it now. And so when humiliation arises, you can sit and have, or when you're holding to humiliation, you could let it just arise and pass if it does. But what we tend to do is, and the holding to that humiliation, then notice, if you want, label having humiliation or having thought humiliation, and then just be breathing, be present. And then, if it appears again, having thought of anger, having thought she, he, I don't know which one it was, is so, was so, or I, how could I? And then again, being right here. And see, in a sense, its continuation after whenever that event was to now is just a cause and effect momentum that constantly wants to reassert self-centeredness. That momentum occurs, and we have the opportunity to liberate it, ourselves, the others, from that by being present, experiencing, despite the fact that we don't want to, despite the fact that anger isn't comfortable to experience, which why we get angrier about the anger, or, you know, that's sort of just, or the humiliation, how could they, how could I, and all it, and the ability to not hold on to that when it appears, but not trying to fight, push it away and add further reaction, is really what the capacity and the strength of sitting and practice is. Just labeling if that's useful, noticing if that's useful, and experiencing. It doesn't mean it won't stop. It might, the waves of it might continue, or they might cease. Or they might cease and reappear, We are not the bosses of the waves of the universe that appear. And yet, we are the boss, to whatever extent, little or big, doesn't make a difference, to the extent that we can, of not clinging in the midst of it, of not holding to the conditions and characteristics that we believe, whether it's we believe it in thoughts and feelings and emotional reaction, bodily, those are just different names for different ways we humans function. So great, you had wonderful fuel to to have your session, to give. And it's very interesting that when that fuel, if I'll use the expression, burns up in the experiencing, it nurtures and energizes us, and it's exactly what we need to take care of. Not because I planned it or you planned it or anyone planned it, but the universe of your life shows that this is what needs to be taken care of, because it's here. Yes, motion, yeah, and then
what Diane just alluded to is, I think, an important point. It's something I've noticed quite a bit. She said the anger was right here, right in front of her. And I think oftentimes what we're holding on to, our stories, as you say, believing our stories, we're so invested in them, and they're so close and seem to be so much a part of us, that we only become aware of them by the effect they have. Effect on us bodily, or the effect they have on the situation or the people that we're with. It's like an analogy, maybe something like gravity. You can't see gravity, but we know it's there by its effect. And oftentimes I'll wonder why the situation is going this way, and it's not the way I want it to go, or why do I have this tension, this knot in my gut? And if I just see the knot in my gut as a real aspect of who, of what is real, then I've missed the opportunity to notice what I'm holding on to that is the source of that tension or that anger or that irritation.
And yet we don't have to see all the forces of the universe. We can't see. In a way, our life is mysterious, and what we see at this moment is sufficient for this moment, and then according to let us say cause and effect, we each see to whatever extent we can. But the seeing is just a byproduct. That the point isn't to go looking for what needs to be seen, but to allow what's seen to be seen. Allow ourselves to see to the extent of our capacity, and then naturally we can see all the more. But the point isn't to get more ideas and knowledge, but rather to be the functioning of the bodhisattvic wisdom and compassion. See, wisdom isn't a list of things that you've seen. Wisdom is the functioning of the universe that is our life. Then, as we breathe, we function. And what's needed, we have to the extent that we have. And we do our best with what is here. And at the same time, as we practice our capacity and ability to see, if I use that kind of word, manifests and grows. But it's not, what should I say, a continuous, constant thing that goes in a certain direction. It's according to circumstances and conditions. Up and down, back and forth, that's just our stories about it. It's not. Because, if I use this word, seeing is unconditioned, it's therefore not limited to the conditions, and yet it's not separate from condition. So, okay? Irvin.
Thanks for the talk, and I wanted to share something that I've been struggling with, and hopefully you might have insight into this. But I teach, and what I try to do is instill in my teaching when I'm standing before like a lecture hall, a sort of, I try to get out of that, what you were talking about, like the egoistic self-indulgence, and try to become one with the students. And I have never, I don't even know if I've ever even gotten close to that. And when I fail at that, I feel terrible, and it makes me feel like I'm a terrible teacher. And I don't know how to go about my teaching where my lectures or even just the questions I provoke for discussion doesn't feel like some self-indulgence. And as a teacher yourself, I wonder like what philosophy undergirds your teaching practice so that you aren't, so you are like sort of one with the world around you and not just this individual voice speaking out to the world.
Well, in a way, as long as we hold on to an idea that I'm trying to get to this and that place, even though you can say that's laudable, at the same time that perpetuates the I that needs to get somewhere else, that needs to get them to be somewhere else, and so on and so forth, I that teaches is that your job is to be the room, be the students, be the material, and as best you can express it in a way that if you're also the students, your attempt is to be the one who hears the material as well as the material, which means, if I say it in theory, it's you're getting out of the way of what you're presenting. So it's not that you're trying to present this to them, but allowing what you're teaching in the classroom, let's say, to come forth without you getting in the way of it, without your getting in the way of it with whether your judgments about yourself or your judgments about them, or even your ideas about how they have to get it. So how do we also be appreciative, intimate with their different and differing capacities to hear it? How do we be willing to express it in ways that might not be the way I want to, but the way that's called for based on what they said or what I know, or and go on and so and hear and see where and how they are. In addition, to notice the judgments that we keep adding on to what you're doing, looking for, just like in sitting, we don't hold on to judgments that we add on to. This sitting was good, this sitting was bad, this I could have sat that way, I could have sat that way. That kind of thinking, that kind of attempted gaining out of our practice gets in the way, because it's constantly distancing itself from the experiencing right here. It's the experiencing right now. In a sense, the hardest and the simplest aspect of sitting and of, let us say, any activity, whether it's teaching or whether it's washing the dishes or whether it's eating food, is allowing self ideas to get out of the way, so to speak. Not to try to fight them, but to let them be permeable and in this bigger container of this present moment. So, but this is something we should talk about individually. And we could talk about specific aspects of how of working with this. So. Yeah, Shoujo.
Well, I have a story. I make up stories all the time, it seems like, and I seem to create things that don't really exist in my reality. Once I think that they do, I can't change my mind with a baseball bat. And the example of that was that I thought I had misplaced or lost or something, a little fine mesh strainer that I had put on the sink so that, you know, garbage and shit doesn't go down into the drains and clog up stuff. And so when I was cleaning up and putting my stuff away like I usually do when the machine comes along, I noticed that one of the strainers that I had was in one side of the sink and the other one was missing. And I thought, well, where did it go? And of course, I thought I had this other strainer somewhere, but I realized, no, I don't really have that strainer. Because, I don't know, I just got this idea that since one was in one part, the other one must be gone if it wasn't in the other sink.
Uh-huh.
But then I thought, well, I guess if I lost, he's going to buy another one. And I thought, well, that's fine, I can do that for only $1.50, $2 at Dollar General. And then thinking about, well, I don't know, somehow whatever you said, I was thinking, well, now what am I going to do with this new strainer? I said, wait a minute, I don't put a strainer on the sink where the garbage disposal is, because it takes care of all that stuff. And so...
Wonderful.
It was quite a relief.
See how easy it is to get relief? Just to discover that your story isn't so. Then the problems and the upset that comes from holding to that story. See, one of the aspects of noticing thoughts and feelings when we're holding to them is that they don't continue to have the power. And then the power to, in a sense, beat us, or to help us beat ourselves, or to beat others. And the more transparent they become of themselves, they cease to have that power, whether in terms of their arising in reactions or arising in to cloud our present moment. See, that's one aspect that happens naturally, if I say it in that way, in being experiencing, in being present, in Zazen and in other aspects of our life. Naturally, this, if I say open mind or bigger mind, or whether we call it beginner's mind, naturally manifests, because from the beginning it's who we are, except when we blind ourselves. See, that's why I could say you are all bodhisattvas. And I could say there is no bodhisattva. There's only bodhisattvic functioning. And you, we all are this capacity for ongoing bodhisattvic functioning. We are this capacity. We just solidify it. And then, unfortunately, sometimes what we solidify it around is a solidity of self-judgmental concerns that create stress, suffering, that naturally result in stress, suffering. Because if you solidify it, then in the midst of what's not solid, you keep bumping into. Because when events occur, when a thought comes up, oh, there's no strainer in this one, then the reactive, oh, someone took it, what did they do? Oh, I'm going to have to buy another one, what are we going to, etc., etc. It's nice that it was so easily resolved. Isn't it wonderful? Think of all the time you would have continued worrying about it and looking, who took it? What did they do? We often, and I don't mean you, but we, all of us, create stories that then give us permission to worry and be angry and upset and concerned, whether about ourselves or others. So to notice them is to allow us to be relieved of that added. In a way, that's what I'll talk about tomorrow, but I don't want to go there quite now, otherwise I won't have anything to say tomorrow and I'll have to work additionally. But good. Yes, Faye.
I really appreciated the poem that you read at the end of the talk. When I hear those words, there's almost a release that occurs.
Yes.
You know, and at some time in everyday life, I can remember that, for a perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's just, it would be great if it was a little more consistent. And yet, when it is, even, it's like sometimes there's, almost feeling too different, you know. I can sometimes be like too separate. Not, I know it's not about being separate, but it's like, because you can see something bigger, you know, I don't really have to get upset, but it's almost like there's an expectation that I'll have some sort of reaction. not just from other people, but even from myself. It's like, what's going on? So, I don't know. I just wanted to mention that, see if you had anything to say.
Nothing good. It's good that you can see there's a reaction expectation, or an expectation of reaction. If such and such, then. And the bodhisattvic compassion and wisdom is acting skillfully and appropriately out of being present. Whether that means simply experiencing and being present, or whether it means doing something. But it's out of the being present or the being experiencing that we then, because we are intimate in this moment with the circumstances of right now, including those thoughts and feeling reactions, but not holding to them, we have more capacity. Doesn't mean that people don't get caught up. Therefore, someone who you think of as, oh, they're really a bodhisattva, they do such wonderful, and then all of a sudden in one event how could they have done that? Because we all can get caught up. And yet it goes the reverse as well. So as soon as we make stories about people, whether because of their function or because of their some other characteristic, then we fail to allow them and us to truly manifest this moment universe that we are, this moment unconditioned that manifests in these conditioned circumstances, as these conditioned circumstances, as this response to what's going on now. Okay? Anyone else here? I have to turn to you because otherwise my eyes don't work. One, two. Okay.
Yeah, in one of the talks of yours that we listened to recently, what all of this brings to mind again for me is your encouragement to look at what it is that seems natural to us. Mm-hmm. And this is sort of everything that you've talked about today. And in Sesshin, it's this wonderful, I don't know how to put it, but it's just this wonderful, it gets all flipped around, turned around, in that what otherwise seems natural, you know, the reacting and the I, and I want this and I don't want that, and then I can really not just see it, but really taste it, that moment of seeing it, oh wow, this is usually sort of the thing that seems natural, and now I can really see it and taste and experience what the natural functioning is, can be. I don't really want to say even that word, but as you put it, the bodhisattvic functioning, and in Sesshin being here together, it is just so simply clear. I don't know, it's just beautiful how that clarity is just available. And then, so.
Yeah, and in part, the form of Sesshin that's stripped bare and simple is what supports and nurtures that, what makes it possible, so that bodhisattvic functioning is when you're eating to chew and taste and be the eating. It's simple in Sesshin because there's little distraction. Thoughts and ideas might come up and you want to be planning what's going to happen next, or you want to be saying, well, how come I didn't get more of this, or how come I had so much of this, or how come they put this in. But because we're encouraged to stay, to appreciate the food as it is, to taste and appreciate the chewing, the swallowing, the room as it is, we have the opportunity to be natural in that way, as opposed to naturally going into judgmental stories, planning, etc., etc., or distractions. So, yeah. And it's that way. I mean, I just picked one activity, but we all know the simple and multiple functionings of Sesshin, which are the multiple and simple functionings of our life, whether it's driving or walking or talking to people or so forth. But in Sesshin it's simpler in a certain way, so that we could see the simplicity of the whole life opportunities. Okay.
yeah, I was just going to bring up, so we have to talk about these quote-unquote negative aspects of clinging, but when it comes to things like, you know, like something beautiful, right?
Uh-huh.
And I feel I often want to maybe like remember those things too. And uh-huh. I mean, I was meant to practice like non-clinging to those things as well, or like fond memories and stuff.
You could, there's no problem with the memories when the memories come up. Enjoy it at that moment. But if you imagine, if you have to keep saying to yourself, oh, I really have to remember that because otherwise I'll forget it. I really have to remember it because everything else now is so terrible. Or then, see, one of the capacities we as humans have is we remember things, and some things we remember very fondly. When fond memories come up, enjoy them. Wonderful. But if we hold on to them to the extent that it blocks us from seeing where we're walking and who we're talking to, then we'll trip. We won't pay attention to the person we're with, and they'll get upset. We'll miss them. So, fond memories, fine. Let them come, let them go. We have, you know, people have pictures, they tell stories. This poem I read was part of a memorial for someone who died. Part of what was said in that memorial was fond memories of that person that came up and that someone wrote out and then offered to others. That's, you know, no problem with that. And yet at the same time, it's embracing what was right now. See, there's a difference between things coming up and us clinging to them or self-centeredly holding on to it. And it's the holding on to, or if you use the other word, attachment, that creates troubles for us. And you don't have to believe me, just simply look at the life and see what happens if and where that happens. If it happens, good. If it doesn't happen, don't worry about it. But many of us can see where that happens. And if that happens, then it's important to... what should I say? To allow the antidote of seeing clearly what's so, experiencing clearly this moment, or not so clearly experiencing this moment, as the antidote to the blindness and stress that's created by exclusively clinging to or exclusively caught in the reacting. I shouldn't say exclusively, primarily. And as quoting from the third ancestor show, this isn't about modern or ancient or anything like that. I mean, he was talking in 6th, 7th century China. See, this is what we humans do. And of course, the historical Buddha was 5th or 4th century India, or Indian subcontinent. This is what we humans do, and it's just different forms in different places. That's one of the wonderful things. Many forms. And yet, our basic capacity of bodhisattvic functioning, compassionate wisdom functioning, is always our opportunity. Okay. Okay, I think I've spoken enough, unless someone has something else they want to bring up. If not, thank you all, and we'll continue.
Copyright Elihu Genmyo Smith.